Let's hear some of that movie chat. Credits roll by and I tip my hat. Credits roll by, wanna know more right away. Let's have some of that movie chat. Credits roll by, tell me who did that. Life in the credits is where I wanna play.
Welcome to Life in the Credits. This is the show where we learn about entertainment by chatting with people who work in the industry. I'm Susan.
And I'm Ben. And today we're discussing the film Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey 2. It was written by Reese Frake Waterfield and Matt Leslie and directed by Reese Frake Waterfield. It stars Scott Chambers, Ryan Oliva, and Tallulah Evans.
And joining us today are special guests, Reese Frake Waterfield and Scott Chambers.
So welcome, guys.
Can you guys tell us each about what you do in the entertainment industry?
So my name is Reese Frake Waterfield. I'm the director and producer of Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey 1 and now Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey 2.
And yeah, I'm Scott. I produced the first film, produced the second one, but also play Christopher Robin in the second one. But I also direct and write, so I do a lot of different bits as well.
Awesome.
Great. That's fantastic. So what was the path for both of your careers?
I have a really bizarre path into the industry because, I didn't actually start in film originally. I kind of done like an economics degree. I then went to an energy company and worked in like corporate strategy there for a while. I was there for about 8 or 9 years. And it was about 3 years ago now, Scott? 3-4 years ago? I just wanted to do a bit of a career change because the entire time I was focusing on stuff which was very very uncreative. It was very, maths and statistics. I was like programming, doing data science-y stuff, and I was getting a bit bored of it and I want to do something different. So I got really jealous of Scott because I saw Scott doing all this film stuff, going and making these films, acting in it, directing it. I was like, I want to do that. So I just quit my job and then moved over and we started, done a couple of films together. I started off like producing and doing just a little bit like VFX and just dipping my toes in and just seeing what the different areas were like. And then I kind of just had a go at directing, writing, and then it's kind of expanded out there. And now I'm mostly focused on directing now.
Nice.
Cool.
Yeah. And I started when I was about 17 as an actor. So that was like my main goal and stuff. I wanted to be an actor and all that kind of stuff. And I did a couple of theatre shows in London and then one got turned into a movie and things started to kind of like move a bit slow and but in the right direction and stuff. And I've been making movies since I was about 11 years old. Like I used my dad's big camera. And I would make always horror films because my older brother got me into horror when I was about 7. He put Scream on and it just went from there. And yeah, I've always made horror films and I've had so much fun in the horror genre. I've been a massive fan. And yeah, it's just been as I say, since 11, I've always made my own films on no money. I've just, whatever I've had, I've just used it and I've gone for it. And that's the good thing about the industry is that it is actually now so accessible. You can use your iPhone and you can make a film. You do not need someone higher up at a studio to say yeah or no. It's you can just go out there, do it yourself, and you can distribute it yourself. And that's what I did. And in between acting jobs, obviously, because in that line of work, it's very much waiting for people to say, yes, you can act. Yes, you can be in our film and all that. And I was like, you know what? Obviously the acting thing, I'm obsessed with it and I love it. But, it's so the stability of it money-wise. I don't come from money. I don't have anyone that helps me. It's very much same with Reese. We're very much on our own. We moved to London with no money and stuff. And I was just like, what can I do to ensure that I have a backup plan that's in the industry, stuff that I love doing. And maybe one day I can cast myself in the films. So I started making films and stuff proper ones, $5,000 movies. That was the budget. And I had a goal in my head. I wanted to make 100 films by a certain age because I was like, what's my unique selling point when I go into a room to pitch for £1 million or $1 million? And I was like, what if I've done 100 feature films on under 100K and I look like a bit of a Terminator as a producer? And then I did the 100 and I was like, what do I do now? And I was like, what if I try and get my company famous? Yeah. People go, oh, you did that. So then I started making stuff like Humpty Dumpty, Jack and Jill, all this kind of stuff. And they weren't really hitting. And then Winnie the Pooh came and there we go.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Fantastic.
So for Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey 1 and 2, what made you want to write a dark version of Winnie the Pooh? And then how does the sequel kind of carry the story along?
I love all horror. And But there's a lot of the same stuff being repeated in the genre, and I wanted to do stuff which was a bit original and a bit different. And when I first started off directing, I actually did really wacky concepts and really crazy stuff, and that's when I was like learning. I directed something which is about a killer Christmas tree, and it's absolutely mad. I still love it. It never really found its audience. It's quite niche and small. And then in January I saw Winnie the Pooh was in the public domain, and then I thought, okay, that's all more wacky and weird. So I was like, okay, I have to direct that. So then we kind of chatted to the execs and I was like, I really want to do this. Let's go over it. I think we can make this really good. And yeah, they said yes, then went ahead with it, wrote it. And my idea for when I was kind of building up that concept is I didn't, because we were so budgetary constrained, I mean, didn't really have much resources. It's really hard to like pull off a kind of Chucky-esque version of Winnie the Pooh. You know, traditionally he's quite small, so a lot of people would naturally think, okay, you're going to make him like Chucky, he's going to run around, but you'd be super reliant on VFX there.
Right.
The Chucky doll is like a million to do. My principal photography was 20 grand.
Yeah.
Wow.
Winnie the Pooh one. So I could maybe afford his little finger. So, so we decided to change him and make him more like anthropomorphic, and he's kind of like a half man, half bear, and he's got more slasher vibes with it. Mm-hmm. But I was still under a lot of time constraints, not just resources. So after directing that Killer Christmas Tree thing, literally a month later, I was on set filming that. So the script and everything had to get wrote super quickly. We had various kind of constraints we had to adhere to. So people outside of we get influenced with the story beyond. Right. It's not just us who are guiding it. Some people wanted it to be more in like a Girls in the Cabin kind of vibe. So that's where the first one went. However, when that blew up and did really well, way beyond the expectation we had, because we thought it was originally going to be like for like a VOD market, and then it's gone worldwide theatrical, it made us realize what sort of scope this has gone to. So when we've kind of gone into the sequel, there's been a lot of improvements with that and a lot of changes relative to the first film. So I had a writer come on board with me called Matthew Leslie, and he wrote Summer of 84, which I loved. And I got in touch with him and I said like what some of my thoughts were, where I wanted to take the story, and he was in agreement. So we collaborated together for about 3 or 4 months prior to filming, and we're really happy with how it's turned out. We had a world premiere the other day, and everyone's spoke very, very positively. Everyone is extremely surprised at the scale the film has gone to relative to the first, and some of the changes involved, so much so that we made the first film in a sense non-canon in the sequel. So what we've done is kind of put the film within a film, a bit like, you know how Stab is within the Scream universe.
Totally.
We've done something like that, basically. So Winnie the Pooh 1, the whole film is now within the Winnie the Pooh 2 world and
that's
universe.
Cool.
It's flipped and it's called Honey and Blood, rather than Blood and Honey. So Blood and Honey is our version, but the film within a film is now Honey and Blood. It's going to set, and that set up a lot of like really interesting things for the films which follow, because you can imagine like, now both those versions of Winnie the Pooh, the Winnie the Pooh in the sequel and the first one, exist within the same universe. I'm considering having them meet at one moment.
Oh, cool.
So you've got Winnie the Pooh 1 meeting Winnie the Pooh 2. I think that'd be a really, really fun moment and fun scene.
Really fun.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the first movie, I mean, the kills are so brutal and they're so shocking. How do you up the ante for the second one? I assume with a bigger budget.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm glad you really liked all of the kills, because that's always a big emphasis for us, because as a horror fan, you know, that's what we love. Like a lot of fans, they want really good kills, and you can only make the kills really as good as the budget kind of entails. You can have these big grand ideas and want all of these like amazing prosthetics and like practical effects in there, but if you don't have the budgetary means to do it, you just can't achieve it. So you need to work within your means. So that's why in like when you won, I was using things like a car out the front of the drive, because it's like they're super easy for us. Everyone's got a car. I can use anyone's car on the set. And we just have a wheel pretend to go over the girl's head. So it doesn't look like, so we're not actually putting a car on her head. So it's a lot more achievable and a lot of cheating involved. With the sequel, because we have more money, we were able to do way more with it. We have a company called the Prosthetic Studio who handle all of the redesigns of the creatures and the gore in the film. And they've worked on big stuff. They did Voldemort, Harry Potter. They've worked on Red Skull and Captain America, Mad Eye Moody, like big, big Hollywood like blockbuster films. So their work is absolutely amazing. And you can probably see a bit of a teaser in it, in the trailer, like the new look of the creatures. Yeah, and at one moment you can see someone who's got a bit of a messed up face, and everyone's like really complimented those elements. But because they're so good and the creatures you can have so much fun with, being able to kind of cultivate some really, really interesting deaths in the film. And at the end of the movie, there's a big set piece and it's absolutely relentless. Like there's about 10 minutes of non-stop death, and it's just one after the other, because it's a big like massacre kind of scene.
Yeah.
And everyone absolutely loved it in the cinema, so it's honestly it's at another level compared to the first film.
Yeah, Reese really had it up against him on the first one, like that budget, like having a better budget, it really does allow him to play a lot more. And I think people will see it in the elements that you're saying, in the prosthetics. You know, we've got more locations, like a lot more. We've got hospitals, we've got houses, we've got raves, there's a chainsaw on fire, we've got stunts. It's mad. So I feel like his imagination was able to kind of go a bit more broad this time.
That's awesome. Fantastic.
Yeah, I'm excited. So Scott, you obviously have a lot of acting experience. You said you really like horror. How do you prep for a role like this, or in a horror movie? Especially you're the kind of the lead, you're Christopher Robin.
Yeah. So prep-wise, I really wish I had the answer that I wish happened. So normally I would prep properly. I would really be breaking down the scripts and like working out my arc and all this kind of stuff, which I did do, but I didn't get to do it to the depth that I would normally do, which made me really nervous going into this, because obviously I'm producing it.
Yeah.
And 3 days before we started shooting, our production designer /costume designer pulled out. Mm. And we very quickly learned that actually he'd done no work. And I'm sat in a cafe trying to order. There's a scene with ravers in it, right? And there's got to be about 80 ravers, and I'm trying to understand body types and order all these costumes, and I was on this tiny budget trying to order all these costumes and help Reese, who was freaking out with ordering stuff for the hospital. So that was weirdly my prep. So when we actually got to day one of the shoot, I was like, please, everyone, I really, really need to do the acting now. I was like, just leave me alone in the nicest way possible. But I was so ill. Like when we got there for day one, my first day was doing the therapist stuff. And you can kind of see a little bit of it in the trailer with me with the lady.
Right.
And I was so ill, not from having a flu, but from pure stress. Me and Reese were so run down by the day one of the shoot. So, it was just kind of like I was trying to get my head in the zone. But the way I would normally prep it is, just, going into kind of the arc for me is really important. Mm-hmm. And like knowing where he's going to begin and end and kind of hitting those beats as we get through it, which I did end up having some time on the set to figure that out. But it was very intense, very challenging. But just making him a key thing for me was likability, because he starts in a place where we find out the first one is a film within our world, but the events were inspired on something, based on something, a massacre that I was involved in. And it was kind of like, obviously, this is a year on, and it's like, how does someone kind of go about their life now? It's going to be a lot of trauma and all that kind of stuff. But I worry, because sometimes when I watch performances that have those elements, they're not that likable. And I was like, this character has to be likable. I don't want it to be like misery guts for the whole film. And I was like, okay, he's got to be hopeful. He's got to be vulnerable. He's got to be, he wants to do better. And, that was something that I really tried to play into, so that hopefully people connect with him and like him and root for him. And I'm not just this person that's out there, I'm crying 24/7. Yeah. So
nice.
And Scott is being a bit modest as well. even though he didn't have much preparation time, everyone who's seen it so far has really complimented the performances in the film and his in particular,
nice.
Such as like the writer, like Matt. He put a post on Twitter recently and he was saying like how amazed he was at what Scott did and stuff. So
awesome.
Even though you didn't have much time, he still did really well. Yeah.
You're a professional. Thanks, got it done.
Well, conversely, I mean, that's a big challenge to deal with. Do you guys have a favorite moment from the film?
Mine's a favorite moment because I have never been this scared on a set in my life. So there was a scene where I'm in a car and a chainsaw that's actually on fire has to burst through the door and like nearly get me. It's kind of hinted at in the trailer a little bit, but there's more that happens with that bloody chainsaw. And I'm in this car and the guy playing wearing the Winnie the Pooh face couldn't really see because we had a rain machine and there's just lots of elements that day.
Right.
And the chainsaw come through one time and it was like, it was quite close. It was like there. And then the next time it was like there. And then they were like, oh, okay, Scott, move forward. And I was like, no, because a minute ago it was there. Like the guy just, the guy playing it, Ryan, it was just like, 1 minute it was closed, then a minute it wasn't. And then I was sat in the car and I looked at the DOP, Vince, and I just went, I'm fucking terrified. And he went, just commit to it. And I was like, I actually feel like I could get stabbed, but because this is my company, who am I going to sue myself?
Right, yeah.
So I was just like,
what are you going to do?
So I just had to commit to it. Yeah, I know. I was just like, if something happens, I'm just screwed. But yeah, that's mine.
Yeah. That's great.
For me, I think it might be... we had an actor involved in this called Simon Callow. I'd seen him act in other things before. And like, I obviously knew he was really, really good. But his role is incredibly crucial in this story for like the backstory and it to feel believable. And we had him on set and he came, I remember we was like, we'd been lighting it for like 4 or 5 hours. We had some issues with like, there was like a rock band playing downstairs that like messed up our sound for a while. But when he was ready to go, when it was all fine, that band was gone. He came upstairs and it was all lit. And then him and Scott were forming opposite each other then. And for me, that was probably my favorite moment of the film because I was thinking, holy fuck, he's amazing. Like, when they were acting, I was like, this is really good. Like
that's awesome.
It was, way beyond what I was expecting, and it was incredibly believable, that scene, and I was so excited to see it all kind of edited together. And everyone who started seeing it really saw the potential in the film at that point. Like there was some people who were like a bit iffy like halfway through production, not because the film, it's just the concept, like Winnie the Pooh, being a horror film, and they saw the first film, and like the first film is like, it has its audience, but obviously it had its challenges as well. But then after everyone saw that scene with Simon and some other elements of the filming, everyone became so much more like excited because they could see what the potential of this end product could be. I was really glad for that because that was super early into the production. It was only like 2 or 3 days into it. As a result of things like that, the end product we've made now, I'm really, really happy with. So I'm super excited for it to kind of get out there in a couple of weeks.
Nice.
Great.
Well, do you guys have any advice for people who are looking to get into like indie filmmaking, horror filmmaking, anything like that?
Yeah, I'd say like you've got to do kind of what Scott did and you just like jump in and just start making films and just go for it. Don't rely too much on theory. Have a bit of a thick skin as well, because everything in film all gets judged on the same sort of level. So if you make a film for 20K, people, and I know this firsthand, people are directly comparing that to literal Marvel films of 200 million. And there are only so much you can do with your resources. But what's important is to think, you know, have I achieved something well on that money? Have I kind of gone beyond what my kind of resources and budgetary means are? And then kind of look to just keep building on it and like developing on it from there. Because you can be being able to like critically assess your work and other people's work is super important for development. It's like any job. You don't start out being your true potential. Like you don't start out at what you can be. You have to like build up and get better and better. And it's really important to know why something isn't working. Like if you make a scene and it's like, oh, it's not coming across scary, or I don't like how the monster's looking in this, or the acting doesn't feel, something feels off about it. Is there a point to this scene? Like being able to criticize all of those elements and look what I should have changed is really important to actually get better and then kind of move up.
Right.
And I'll just add to it, this industry is really accessible. Like when I entered it, when I was 17, I didn't feel like it was. And I really felt like, I don't understand how I'm ever going to make it. And I wanted this so bad. Like as an actor, and I've always been making my films in the background, but I didn't even think that was a possibility. That's why it was always just nothing to me. It was like, I make my little films, but you know, it has to be £1 million and all that. No, it is so accessible. So anyone watching, like you can do this. Like, you know, you do not need a showreel with 5 minutes of your acting in it. Just use your mobile and film a monologue, find a scene, just film, make stuff, post it, keep improving, work on your accents, try and be the one that can do everything, try and learn your lines quicker than everyone else. Always try and be the best. Like even if you know, there, you know, there's certain things like that you will never be the best at, but just aim high. And with making films and stuff, like our generation, like we really are, it is quite different now. Like I feel like we all have to be creatives in multiple ways and don't just focus on what you want to do. Like try and get your head in all the other jobs. Like to me, it's crazy that people go to drama school for 3 years and only learn to act. Right. Why are you not learning all the other jobs? Because as an actor, it's like understanding the light, understanding why when someone asks you to move somewhere, you don't question it on the day because you get it. Do you know what I mean? Or, you know, to just make things easier for everyone. There's so many jobs, like assistant directors, their jobs are incredibly important with schedule. As an actor, you can help them in so many ways. And, you know, I've firsthand seen some actors be really difficult, but it's not just actors, it's crew. Understand what it is to be an actor as well. Like, you know, when you're on camera and everyone's rushing and everyone's being really loud behind camera, and then you're asking them to have a mental breakdown over their mum or dad being dead. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just feel like try everyone's jobs out. And again, it is so easy to be able to do that. You don't need to go to film school. I didn't do it. Reese didn't do it. I got turned down at drama school. I auditioned when I was 17. But then the next year I did my first feature film that I got, you know, really nice sort of reviews for in the UK and stuff like that. It's like, if one thing doesn't work out, don't let it stop you. But money is a thing. Like, I remember how depressed I felt in my early 20s. Like, I felt so low because I just had no income and I was working so hard. I was making all these films and not getting paid. All the reports would come through. I'd never earn money from these films. But just keep going. That's what I'd say.
Yeah, nice.
Great. And there's so many, in terms of like jobs and stuff, like when we started off, we were making really low budget films and we were just doing like a high volume of them. And we've since moved up after what's happened with Winnie. But there are other companies out there, people who make films on not much at all, like 15 grand, 20 grand. And they're more for like the smaller VOD market.
Right.
Because not everything needs to be aimed towards Netflix and stuff. And it's important to like not just like shun these companies, because what they're doing, even though obviously the quality of the film isn't as strong as something which is made for $1 million or 2 million, what they are doing is they're giving people their first opportunity in film.
Yes.
Like people get to experience things. They get to learn these things alongside the production learning things and develop themselves in order to move up like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's great.
But that's something that, just to tag on to that, is like sometimes there's like two sets of indie filmmakers, some that really go against what Risa just said, like, you know, your entry-level films, but they are so important. Like for me, that was my training ground. Yeah. And I do feel like indie filmmakers need to support each other. You know, if you don't want to do a low budget, don't do it. But, you know, they're there for a reason and they help so many people like myself that couldn't afford film school.
Yeah, and there can be a bit of like gatekeeping and thinking, people thinking, oh, you shouldn't be making a film unless it's 400K because everyone needs to be on £250 a day or something equivalent to that, or £300 a day. But it's like, I completely disagree with it, because not everyone has the means to jump up to that level. It's important.
Yeah, we would never be here if that was process. The case. I would never have done it.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, gentlemen, where and when can people see Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey 2?
On the 26th of March, it's going to be releasing in the USA in 1,500 screens, so basically all nationwide. It will be going on the 26th, 27th, 28th. That will be the same in most English-speaking countries, like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, all other kind of areas it needs to be dubbed. So foreign countries like the Mexico, Netherlands, Belgium, they're all doing theatrical as well, but they are probably looking to release around about mid-April because they need a bit more time to do all of the dubbing and such. And then the kind of generic like VOD DVD release for everything worldwide is seemingly looking towards about mid-June.
Nice. July.
We'd like to finish up our show today with a game that we're calling All Grown Up. In honor of Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey 2, we're going to see how well you know classic characters who mature over multiple projects. So Reese and Scott, you'll be playing against each other. So here are the rules. I'm going to describe a classic character from TV and movies. What you have to do is shout out the character's name. You'll earn a point if you're correct, and if you're incorrect, the other player will get a chance to answer. I have 5 questions for you to answer, and the person with the most points at the end will win our prize. And Susan, what's our prize?
Some Life in the Credits merchandise.
All righty, let's play.
Here's number 1. This character started in comic books, but has appeared in every form of media. His nicknames and projects include The Brave and the Bold, The Caped Crusader, and The Dark Knight.
Batman.
Yes, that Batman. Is correct. you were on the board with one. Point. All right, number two. This classic family started on Tracy Ullman's show and launched the longest running scripted primetime television series ever. And they have their own movie. Hailing from Springfield, their adventures and misadventures. Yes, Simpsons. That is correct. Yeah. The Simpsons is correct. All right, so Reese, you're at 2 points. We have three more questions for you guys. These four brothers have typically been depicted as teens, but they've been portrayed with a wide range of maturity across multiple comic book series, multiple Michael Bay films, and a rad 80s movie.
Ninja Turtles.
Yes,
yeah, that's right. Nice job.
Ninja Turtles is correct. You're on the board, Scott, with 1 point.
One.
Number four. This classic character from literature has been portrayed many times, but he always seeks to steal from the rich and give to the poor.
Robin Hood.
Yes, Reese, you've sealed the game.
Oh, I'm going to call that.
3 points. And we're going to do one last question just for fun. Another classic character, he fights flies and crows whenever he's in a Disney cartoon or a Steven Spielberg movie. All it takes is a little fairy dust and a happy thought to defeat the pirate Captain Hook.
Peter Pan, isn't it?
Peter Pan. Nice job.
Well, it's Peter Pan.
Crows?
All right. You're both going to get prizes.
Yeah.
You're both going to get some life in the credits merch. But thank you guys so much.
Scott's directing Peter Pan in 1 or 2months, and he missed that.
That's all right. We're going to give you that point just for that.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for joining us. And just one more time, Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey 2 does hit theaters nationwide March 26th, 27th, and 28th via Fathom Events. So make sure you check it out in theaters. Thank you guys so much for joining us.
Yeah, really thanks, guys.
And we're really excited to see it in theaters.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks, guys.
Yeah. Life in the Credits is hosted and produced by me, Susan Swarner.
And me, Ben Bloom.
It's executive produced by Michelle Levin.
The music is written and performed by Steve Trowbridge. You can hear more of Steve's music at TrowbridgeSounds.com.
The show logo is created by Melissa Durkin.
If you'd like to support Life in the Credits and get access to exclusive perks, you can do so at Patreon.com.
If you'd like to follow or get a hold of us, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Life in the Credits, or shoot us an email at lifeinthecredits@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Every one of our cats is coming over here. They're like, we never get to do this part.